This is disc number 9.
There are certain people, I said to Michelle, who, when they imagine a day of the week, see a color, which makes it more vivid. They might think of Wednesdays as red, Thursdays as blue, Fridays as black. Oh, she said. I asked her if she had that ability. Well, not a color code like that. She had scenes for the days of the week. For Monday, I picture my classroom at the Child Development Center. For the word hello, I picture the little room off to the right of the lobby of Belle Willard. Holy cow, Carol erupted. She explained that Michelle went to Belle Willard, a special education center, from the time she was 14 months old until she was 2 years and 10 months. I went through the days of the week with her. Each was attached to a scene. Saturday. She explained that she sees a toy merry-go-round with a light green bottom and a yellow top, with holes in it, near where she lives. She imagines having sat on a merry-go-round toy as a child, and sat is the first syllable of Saturday, which she guesses is why she experiences Saturday connected to the scene. Sunday has a scene with sunshine, and the sun sound is the length. But other days have scenes she couldn't explain. Friday, a bird's-eye view of the pancake griddle that was used in our old kitchen, which she had last seen about 18 years ago, before the kitchen was remodeled. Perhaps she associated Friday with the griddle because it is used to fry foods. Jordan Grafman is the research scientist trying to figure out how Michelle's brain works. After Carol read his article on plasticity, she contacted him, and he said she could bring Michelle in for a visit. Ever since, Michelle has gone for testing, and he has used what he discovers to help her adapt to her situation and to better understand how her brain developed. Grafman has a warm smile, a musical voice, and fair hair, and his broad, white-coated 6-foot frame fills his small book-lined office at the National Institutes of Health. He is chief of the Cognitive Neurosciences Section, National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke. He has two main interests: understanding the frontal lobes and neuroplasticity, the two subjects taken together that help explain Michelle's extraordinary strengths and her cognitive difficulties. For 20 years, Grafman served as a captain in the United States Air Force Biomedical Sciences Command. He received a Defense Meritorious Service Medal for his work as head of the Vietnam Head Injury Study. He has probably seen more people with frontal lobe injuries than anyone else in the world. His own life is an impressive story of transformation. When Jordan was in elementary school, his father had a devastating stroke that caused a type of brain damage, then poorly understood by physicians, that changed his personality. He had emotional outbursts and what is called euphemistically in neurology, social disinhibition, meaning the release of the aggressive and sexual instincts normally repressed or inhibited. Nor could he seem to grasp the main point of what people were saying. Jordan did not understand what was causing his father's behavior. Jordan's mother divorced her husband, who lived the rest of his life in a transient hotel in Chicago, where he died of a second stroke alone in a back alley. Jordan, in deep pain, stopped attending elementary school and became a juvenile delinquent. Yet something in him longed for more, and he started spending his mornings in the public library reading, discovering Dostoevsky and other great novelists. In the afternoons, he visited the Art Institute until he learned it was a cruising spot where young boys were targets. He spent evenings in Old Town's jazz and blues clubs. On the streets, he got a real psychological education, learning by trial and error what makes people tick. To avoid being sent to the St. Charles Reformatory, essentially a jail for kids under 16, he spent 4 years in a boys' home and reform school, where he saw a social worker for the psychotherapy, which he felt rescued him and prepared me for the rest of my life. He graduated from high school and fled what had become for him a brown-gray Chicago to a pastel California. He fell in love with Yosemite and decided to become a geologist. But by chance, he took a course in the psychology of dreams and found it so fascinating he changed his concentration to psychology. His first encounter with neuroplasticity was in 1977, When he was in graduate school at the University of Wisconsin working with a brain-damaged African-American woman who had made an unexpected recovery. Renata, as he calls her, had been strangled in an assault in Central Park in New York City and left for dead. The attack cut off oxygen to her brain long enough to cause an anoxic injury. Neuronal death from the lack of oxygen. Grafman first saw her more than 5 years after the attack, after the doctors had given up on her. Her motor cortex had been so severely damaged that she had great trouble moving, was disabled and wheelchair-bound. Her muscles wasted away. The team believed she probably had damage to her hippocampus. She had severe memory problems and could barely read. Since the assault, her life had been one downward spiral. She couldn't work and lost her friends. Patients like Renata were assumed to be beyond help, since anoxic injury leaves behind vast amounts of dead brain tissue, and most clinicians believed that when brain tissue dies, the brain cannot recover. Nevertheless, the team Grafman was working on began giving Renata intensive training, the kinds of physical rehab usually given to patients only in the first weeks after their injuries. Grafman had been doing memory research, knowing about rehabilitation, and wondered what would happen if the two fields were integrated. He suggested that Renata begin memory, reading, and thinking exercises. Grafman had no idea that Paul Bacarita's father had actually benefited from a similar program 20 years before. She started to move more and become more communicative and more able to concentrate and think and to remember day-to-day events. Ultimately, she was able to go back to school, get a job, and re-enter the world. Though she never completely recovered, Grafman was amazed by her progress, saying these interventions had so improved the quality of her life that it was stunning. The U.S. Air Force put Grafman through graduate school. In return, he was commissioned a captain and made director of the neuropsychological component of the Vietnam Head Injury Study, where he had his second exposure to brain plasticity. Since soldiers face toward the battlefield, its torrent of flying metal often enters and damages the tissues in the front of their brains, the frontal lobes, which coordinate other parts of the brain and help the mind focus on the main point of a situation, form goals, and make lasting decisions. Grafman wanted to understand what factors most affected recovery from frontal lobe injuries, so he began to examine how a soldier's health, genetics, social status, and intelligence prior to his injury might predict his chance of recovery. Since everyone in the service has to take the Armed Forces Qualifications Test, roughly equivalent to an IQ test, Grafman could study the relationship of pre-injury intelligence to that after recovery. He found that aside from the size of the wounds and the location of the injury, a soldier's IQ was a very important predictor of how well he would recover his lost brain functions. Having more cognitive ability, intelligence to spare, enabled the brain to respond better to severe trauma. Grafman's data suggested that highly intelligent soldiers seemed better able to reorganize their cognitive abilities to support the areas that had been injured. As we have seen, according to strict localizationism, each cognitive function is processed in a different genetically predetermined location. If that location is wiped out by a bullet, so should its functions be, forever, unless the brain is plastic and capable of adapting and creating new structures to replace the damaged ones. Grafman wanted to explore plasticity's limits and potential, to discover how long structural reorganization takes, and to understand whether there are different types of plasticity. He reasoned that because each person with a brain injury has uniquely affected areas, paying close attention to individual cases was often more productive than were large group studies. Grafman's view of the brain integrates a non-doctrinaire version of localizationism with plasticity. The brain is divided into sectors, and in the course of development, each acquires a primary responsibility for a particular kind of mental activity. In complex activities, several sectors must interact. When we read, the meaning of a word is stored or mapped in one sector of the brain. The visual appearance of the letters is stored in another, and its sound in yet another. Each sector is bound together in a network, so that when we encounter the word, we can see it, hear it, and understand it. Neurons from each sector have to be activated at the same time, co-activated, for us to see, hear, and understand at once. The rules for storing all this information reflect the use-it-or-lose-it principle. The more frequently we use a word, the more easily we'll find it. Even patients with brain damage to the word sector are better able to retrieve words they used frequently before their injury than those they used infrequently. Grafman believes that in any area of the brain that performs an activity, such as storing words, it is the neurons in the center of that area that are most committed to the task. Those on the border are far less committed, so adjacent brain areas compete with each other to recruit these border neurons. Daily activities determine which brain area wins this competition. For a postal worker who looks at addresses on envelopes without thinking about their meaning, the neurons on the boundary between the visual area and the meaning area will become committed to representing the look of the word. For a philosopher interested in the meaning of words, those boundary neurons will become committed to representing meaning. Grafman believes that everything we know from brain scans about these boundary areas tell us that they can expand quickly, within minutes, to respond to our moment-by-moment needs. From his research, Grafman has identified four kinds of plasticity. The first is map expansion, described above, which occurs largely at the boundaries between brain areas as a result of daily activity. The second is sensory reassignment, which occurs when one sense is blocked, as in the blind. When the visual cortex is deprived of its normal inputs, it can receive new inputs from another sense, such as touch. The third is compensatory masquerade, which takes advantage of the fact that there's more than one way for your brain to approach a task. Some people use visual landmarks to get from place to place. Others, with a good sense of direction, have a strong spatial sense, so if they lose their spatial sense in a brain injury, they can fall back on landmarks. Until neuroplasticity was recognized, compensatory masquerade, also called compensation or alternative strategies, such as switching people with reading problems to audio tapes, was the chief method used to help children with learning disabilities. The fourth kind of plasticity is mirror region takeover. When part of one hemisphere fails, the mirror region in the opposite hemisphere adapts, taking over its mental function as best it can. This last idea grew out of work Grafman and his colleague Harvey Levin did with a boy I shall call Paul, who was in a car accident when he was 7 months old. A blow to his head pushed the bones of his fractured skull into his right parietal lobe, the top central part of the brain, behind the frontal lobes. Grafman's team first saw Paul when he was 17. Surprisingly, he was having problems with calculation and number processing. People with right parietal injuries are expected to have problems processing visual spatial information. Grafman and others had established that it is the left parietal lobe of the brain that normally stores mathematical facts and performs calculations involved in simple arithmetic, yet Paul's left lobe had not been injured. A CAT scan showed that Paul had a cyst on his injured right side. Then Grafman and Levin did an fMRI scan, functional magnetic resonance imaging, and while Paul's brain was being scanned, gave him simple arithmetic problems. The scan showed there was a very weak activation of the left parietal area. They concluded from these odd results that the left area was weakly activated during arithmetic because it was now processing the visual spatial information that could no longer be processed by the right parietal lobe. The car accident occurred before 7-month-old Paul was required to learn arithmetic, therefore before the left parietal lobe was committed to becoming a specialized processing area for calculation. During the time between 7 months and 6 years, when he started learning arithmetic, it had been far more important for him to navigate, for which he required visual spatial processing. So visual spatial activity found its home in the part of the brain that most closely approximated the right parietal lobe, the left parietal lobe. Paul could now navigate through the world, but at a cost. When he had to learn arithmetic, the central part of the left parietal sector was already committed to visual spatial processing. Grafman's theory provides an explanation of how Michelle's brain evolved. Michelle's loss of brain tissue occurred before there could have been any significant commitment of her right hemisphere. Since plasticity is at its height in the earliest years, what probably saved Michelle from certain death was that her damage occurred so early. When her brain was still forming, her right hemisphere had time to adjust in the womb, and Carol was there to care for her. It is possible that her right hemisphere, which normally processes visual spatial activities, was able to process speech because, being partially blind and barely able to crawl, Michelle learned to speak before she learned to see and walk. Speech would have trumped visual spatial needs in Michelle, just as visual spatial needs had trumped arithmetical needs in Paul. Migration of a mental function to the opposite hemisphere can happen because early in development our hemispheres are quite similar, and only later do they gradually specialize. Brain scans of babies in their first year show that they process new sounds in both hemispheres. By age 2, they usually process these new sounds in the left hemisphere, which has begun to specialize in speech. Grafman wondered whether visual spatial ability, like language in babies, is initially present in both hemispheres and then inhibited in the left as the brain specializes. In other words, each hemisphere tends to specialize in certain functions, but is not hardwired to do so. The age at which we learn a mental skill strongly influences the area in which it gets processed. As infants, we are slowly exposed to the world around us, and as we learn new skills, the most suitable processing sectors of our brains that are as yet uncommitted are the ones used to process those skills. Which means, says Grafman, that if you take 1,000,000 people and you look at the same areas of their brains, you will see those areas more or less committed to performing the same functions or processes. But he adds, they may not be in the exact same place, and they shouldn't be, because each of us will have different life experiences. The riddle of the relationship between Michelle's extraordinary abilities and her difficulties is explained by Grafman's work on the frontal lobe. Specifically, his work on the prefrontal cortex helps explain the price Michelle has had to pay to survive. The prefrontal lobes are the part of the brain that is most uniquely human, as they are most developed in human beings relative to other animals. Grafman's theory is that over the course of evolution, the prefrontal cortex developed the ability to capture and retain information over longer and longer periods of time, allowing human beings to develop both foresight and memory. The left frontal lobe became specialized in storing memories of individual events, and the right in extracting a theme or the main point from a series of events or from a story. Foresight involves extracting the theme from a series of events before they completely unfold, and it is a great advantage in life. To know that when a tiger crouches, it is preparing to attack may help you survive. The person with foresight doesn't have to experience the entire series of events to know what is likely coming. People with right prefrontal lesions have impaired foresight. They can watch a movie, but they can't get the main point or see where the plot is going. They don't plan well, since planning involves ordering a series of events so that they lead toward a desired outcome, goal, or main point. Nor do people with right frontal lesions execute their plans well. Unable to keep to the main point, they are easily distracted. They are often socially inappropriate because they don't get the main point of social interactions, which are also a series of events, and they have difficulty understanding metaphors and similes, which requires extracting the main point or theme from various details. If a poet says, "A marriage is a battle zone," it is important to know that the poet doesn't mean the marriage consists of actual explosions and dead bodies. Rather, it is a husband and wife fighting intensely. All the areas Michelle has difficulty with, getting the main point, understanding proverbs, metaphors, concepts, and abstract thought, are right prefrontal activities. Grafman's standardized psychological testing confirmed that she has difficulty planning, sorting out social situations, understanding motives, a version of getting the main theme applied to social life, and also some problems empathizing with and forecasting the behavior of others. Her relative absence of foresight, Grafman thinks, increases her level of anxiety and makes it harder for her to control her impulses. On the other hand, She has a savant's ability to remember individual events and the exact dates they occurred, a left prefrontal function. Grafman believes Michelle has the same kind of mirror area adaptation as Paul, but that her mirror sights are her prefrontal lobes. Because one usually masters registering the occurrence of events before one learns to extract their main theme, event registration, most often a left prefrontal function, so occupied her right prefrontal lobe that theme extraction never had a chance to fully develop. When I met with Grafman after I saw Michelle, I asked him why she remembers events so much better than the rest of us. Why not just a normal ability? Grafman thinks that her superior ability to remember events may be related to the fact that she has only one hemisphere. Normally, the two hemispheres are in constant communication. Each not only informs the other of its own activities, but also corrects its mate, at times restraining it and balancing the other's eccentricity. What happens when that hemisphere is stricken and can no longer inhibit its partner? A dramatic example has been described by Dr. Bruce Miller, a professor of neurology at the University of California, San Francisco, who has shown that some people who develop frontotemporal lobe dementia in the left side of their brain lose their ability to understand the meaning of words but spontaneously develop unusual artistic, musical, and rhyming skills, skills usually processed in the right temporal and parietal lobes. Artistically, they become particularly good at drawing details. Miller argues that the left hemisphere normally acts like a bully, inhibiting and suppressing the right. As the left hemisphere falters, the right's uninhibited potential can emerge. In fact, people without disabilities can benefit from liberating one hemisphere from another. Betty Edwards's popular book, Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain, written in 1979, years before Miller's discovery, taught people to draw by developing ways to stop the verbal, analytical left hemisphere from inhibiting the right hemisphere's artistic tendencies. Inspired by the neuroscientific research of Richard Sperry, Edwards taught that the verbal, logical, and analytical left hemisphere perceives in ways that actually interfere with drawing and tends to overpower the right hemisphere, which is better at drawing. Edwards's primary tactic was to deactivate the left hemisphere's inhibition of the right by giving the student a task the left hemisphere would be unable to understand and so turn down. For instance, she had students draw a picture of a Picasso sketch while looking at it upside down and found they did a far better job than when doing it right side up. Students would develop a sudden knack for drawing rather than acquiring the skill gradually. In Grafman's view, Michelle's superior registration of events might have developed because, once event registration developed in her right hemisphere, there was no left hemisphere to inhibit it, as usually happens after the main point has been extracted and the details are often no longer important. Since there are many thousands of brain activities going on at once, we need forces to inhibit, control, and regulate our brains in order to keep us sane, organized, and in control of ourselves so we don't ride off in all directions at once. It would seem that the most frightening thing about brain disease is that it might erase certain mental functions. But just as devastating is a brain disease that leads us to express parts of ourselves we wish didn't exist. Much of the brain is inhibitory, and when we lose that inhibition, unwanted drives and instincts emerge full force, shaming us and devastating our relationships and families. A few years ago, Jordan Grafman was able to get the records from the hospital where his own father had been diagnosed with the stroke that led to his loss of inhibition and his ultimate deterioration. He discovered that his father's stroke had been in the right frontal cortex, the area Grafman had spent the past quarter century studying. Before I leave, I am to get the tour of Michelle's inner sanctum. "This is my bedroom," she says proudly. It is painted blue and crammed with her collection of stuffed bears, Mickey and Minnie Mouse, and Bugs Bunny. On her bookshelves are hundreds of the Babysitter's Club books, a series that often appeals to girls in the years just before puberty. She has a collection of Carol Burnett tapes and loves easy rock from the 1960s and 1970s. Seeing the room, I wonder about her social life. Carol explains that she was a loner growing up. She loved books instead. "You didn't seem to want to have others around," she says to Michelle. One doctor thought she demonstrated some autistic behaviors, but that she was not autistic, and I can see she's not. She's courteous, recognizes people's comings and goings, and is warm and connected to her parents. She longs for a connection to people and feels hurt when they don't look her in the eye, as so often happens when normal people encounter those with disabilities. Hearing the autism comment, Michelle pipes up, "My theory is that I always like to be alone because that way I would not cause any trouble." She has many painful memories of trying to play with other kids and of their not knowing how to play with someone with her disabilities, particularly her hypersensitivity to sounds. I ask her if she has any friends from the past whom she keeps in touch with now. "No," she says. "Nope, nobody," whispers Carol solemnly. I ask Michelle whether during 8th or 9th grades, when boys and girls become more social, she got interested in dating. "No, no, I didn't." She says she's never had a crush on anyone. She's never really been interested. "Did you ever dream you'd get married?" "I don't think so." There is a theme to her preferences, tastes, and longings. The Babysitter's Club, Carol Burnett's harmless humor, the toy bear collection, and everything else I saw in Michelle's blue room were part of that phase of development called latency, the relatively calm period that precedes the storm of puberty, with its erupting instincts. Michelle, it seemed to me, showed many latency passions, and I found myself wondering whether the absence of her left lobe had affected her hormonal development, even though she was a fully developed woman. Perhaps these tastes were the result of her protected upbringing, or perhaps her difficulty understanding the motives of others led her to a world in which the instincts are quieted and where humor is gentle. Carol and Wally, loving parents of a child with a disability, believe they must make preparations for Michelle after they are gone. Carol is doing her best to line up Michelle's siblings to help out, so that Michelle isn't left alone. She's hoping Michelle will be able to get a job in the local funeral home when the woman who does data entry retires, sparing Michelle the travel she dreads. The Macs have had other anxieties and near tragedies to endure. Carol has had cancer. Michelle's brother Bill, whom Carol describes as a thrill seeker, has had many incidents. The day he was voted head of the rugby team, his mates flipped him into the air to celebrate, and he landed on his head, breaking his neck. Fortunately, a top-notch surgical team saved him from a life of paralysis. As Carol started to tell me how she went to the hospital to tell Bill that God was trying to get his attention, I looked at Michelle. She seemed serenely quiet, and a smile was on her face. "What are you thinking, Michelle?" I asked. "I'm fine," she said. "But you are smiling. Are you finding this interesting?" "Yeah," she said. "I bet I know what she's thinking," said Carol. "What?" said Michelle. "About heaven," said Carol.
"I think so, yeah."
"Michelle," said Carol, "has very deep faith. In many ways, it is a very simple faith. Michelle has an idea of what heaven is going to be like, and whenever she thinks about it, you see this smile." "Do you ever dream at night?" I ask. "Yes," she answered. "In little snatches, but no nightmares, mostly daydreams." "About what?" I asked. "Mostly about upstairs, heaven." I asked her to tell me about it, and she got excited. "Okay, sure," she said. "There are some people for whom I have very high regard, and my wish is that these people would live together unisexually nearby, the women in one place and the men in another. And two of the men would agree with each other that I should be given and offered to live with the women." Her mother and father are also there. They all live in a high-rise apartment building, but her parents are on a lower floor, and Michelle lives with the women. "She broke it to me one day," said Carol. "She said, 'I hope you don't mind, but when we all get to heaven, I don't want to live with you.'" I said, "Okay." I asked Michelle what the people will do for entertainment, and she answered, "Things that they would normally do on vacation here, you know, like play miniature golf, not work-type stuff." "Would the men and women ever date?"
"I don't know. I know they would get together, but for fun stuff."
"Do you see heaven as having material things like trees and birds?"
"Oh, yeah, yeah. And another thing about heaven is that all the food up there is fat-free and calorie-free, so that we would be able to have all the food we want, and we wouldn't have to use money to pay for things. And then she added something her mother had always told her about heaven. There is always happiness in heaven. There aren't any medical problems at all, just happiness. I see the smile, an overflow of inner peace. In Michelle's heaven are all the things she's striving for. More human contact, vague hints of increased but safely circumscribed relations between men and women. All that has given her pleasure. Yet all this occurs in an afterworld where, though she is more independent, she can find the parents she so loves not too far away. She has no medical problems, nor does she wish for the other half of her brain. She's fine there, just as she is. Appendix 1. The Culturally Modified Brain. Not only does the brain shape culture, culture shapes the brain. What is the relationship between the brain and culture? The conventional answer of scientists has been that the human brain, from which all thought and action emanate, produces culture. Based on what we have learned about neuroplasticity, this answer is no longer adequate. Culture is not just produced by the brain. It is also, by definition, a series of activities that shape the mind. The Oxford English Dictionary gives one important definition of culture: the cultivating or development of the mind, faculties, manners, etc., improvement or refinement by education and training, the training, development, and refinement of the mind, tastes, and manners. We become cultured through training in various activities, such as customs, arts, ways of interacting with people, and the use of technologies, and the learning of ideas, beliefs, shared philosophies, and religion. Neuroplastic research has shown us that every sustained activity ever mapped, including physical activities, sensory activities, learning, thinking, and imagining, changes the brain as well as the mind. Cultural ideas and activities are no exception. Our brains are modified by the cultural activities we do, be they reading, studying music, or learning new languages. We all have what might be called a culturally modified brain, and as cultures evolve, they continually lead to new changes in the brain. As Merzenich puts it, our brains are vastly different, in fine detail, from the brains of our ancestors. In each stage of cultural development, the average human had to learn complex new skills and abilities that all involve massive brain change. Each one of us can actually learn an incredibly elaborate set of ancestrally developed skills and abilities in our lifetimes, in a sense generating a recreation of this history of cultural evolution via brain plasticity. So, a neuroplasticity-informed view of culture and the brain implies a two-way street. The brain and genetics produce culture, but culture also shapes the brain. Sometimes these changes can be dramatic. The Sea Gypsies. The Sea Gypsies are nomadic people who live in a cluster of tropical islands in the Burmese archipelago and off the west coast of Thailand. A wandering water tribe, they learn to swim before they learn to walk, and live over half their lives in boats on the open sea, where they are often born and die. They survive by harvesting clams and sea cucumbers. Their children dive down, often 30 feet beneath the water's surface, and pluck up their food, including small morsels of marine life, and have done so for centuries. By learning to lower their heart rate, they can stay underwater twice as long as most swimmers. They do this without any diving equipment. One tribe, the Sulu, dive over 75 feet for pearls. But what distinguishes these children, for our purposes, is that they can see clearly at these great depths without goggles. Most human beings cannot see clearly underwater because as sunlight passes through water, it is bent or refracted so that light doesn't land where it should on the retina. Anna Gislén, a Swedish researcher, studied the sea gypsies' ability to read placards underwater and found that they were more than twice as skillful as European children. The gypsies learned to control the shape of their lenses and, more significantly, to control the size of their pupils, constricting them 22%. This is a remarkable finding because human pupils reflexively get larger underwater, and pupil adjustment has been thought to be a fixed, innate reflex controlled by the brain and nervous system. This ability of the sea gypsies to see underwater isn't the product of a unique genetic endowment. Gislin has since taught Swedish children to constrict their pupils to see underwater. One more instance of the brain and nervous system showing unexpected training effects that alter what was thought to be a hardwired, unchangeable circuit. Cultural activities change brain structure. The sea gypsies' underwater sight is just one example of how cultural activities can change brain circuits, in this case leading to a new and seemingly impossible change in perception. Though the gypsies' brains have yet to be scanned, we do have studies that show cultural activities changing brain structure. Music makes extraordinary demands on the brain. A pianist performing the 11th variation of the 6th Paganini Etude by Franz Liszt must play a staggering 1,800 notes per minute. Studies by Taub and others of musicians who play stringed instruments have shown that the more these musicians practice, the larger the brain maps for their active left hands become, and the neurons and maps that respond to string timbres increase.